17 months after you leave prison, you're in the Premier League.
I'm playing in the Premier League. Never been coached up until 23.
That's incredible. Crazy. I said to Jamie off air, I said, this is something that would never happen again.
I'm glad I made my mum and dad proud. That's the biggest thing for me.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to our cosy studio. Max and Luke with you, as always. Luke, how are you?
Really good, thanks, Max. You good?
Good. I brought a few more wares in with me this week. Got a new scarf on the bookshelf.
Yeah, nice. And what else we got?
Baseball bat.
Nice. Well done, mate.
Taxi driver was asking some questions. Today's guest is Jamie Lawrence, sat between us. A story that proves football journeys don't always follow a straight line. From twice serving time in prison to stepping out at Premier League and international level, Jamie's rise is one of resilience, redemption and relentless belief. Along the way, he's represented clubs including Sunderland, Leicester and Bradford, winning the League Cup with the Foxes and earning 24 caps for Jamaica. But beyond football, this is a conversation about what it really takes to rebuild a life, not just a career. Jamie Lawrence, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us for this.
Oh, I'm looking forward to this one. You know, we've been looking for sports people with stories of adversity. How do you get to the top of your industry, your sport? But I think that this could be probably the most unbelievable story, really. I don't think something like what Jamie went through and to get to the Premier League representing those clubs that you just mentioned, I don't think you'll ever see the likes of it again.
Yeah, because you're often described as the only man to go from prison to the Premier League. How does it feel hearing your life summed up like that?
You know what, sometimes I have to pinch myself to think that it happened to me, but I also had a lot of help along the way, which I'm also grateful to the people who have been in my corner, because it would have been easy for especially managers and the prison authorities to not back me in any way or form. And I probably would have been in and out of prison all my life.
Let's try and get to know you a little bit more then to follow this path. So you're born in Balham, 1970. Yeah. Fellow Pisces.
Are you Pisces, yeah?
Yeah, I'm 2 days before you. March the 8th, you're all right?
Yeah, I'm March the 8th. March the 6th, yeah?
Yeah. One of nine siblings.
Yeah.
Does it make you lonelier or more part of a team in your perspective?
No, we had a close family. A lot of my siblings are like in Jamaica, America, Canada and whatever. So we're all over the world. And I'm the youngest in my family. So I'm probably the most spoiled one in the family as well. Everyone looks out for me. But my mum and dad went back to Jamaica when I was 17. That was a turning point. Because as a kid, I was good. I was good at school. I was good at every single sport, athletics, boxing, no matter what I turned my hand to, I was decent. And I always wanted to play football. And I had trials at Surrey in cricket as well. So I was good.
Oh, did you? Yeah. How'd you get on?
Done all right, but I never got in the end, but I done all right. Just to have trials anyway, it's a big achievement back then as well.
Obviously, you mentioned there that you was on pretty much a straight and narrow road at the time. Yeah. And then your mum and dad, they at the age of 17, they moved back to Jamaica.
Yeah.
What was it that made everything completely flip? Was it the fact that there was no one to reprimand you if you did get in trouble, and you suddenly felt like, do you know what, like no one's really going to be on my case here if I?
It's accumulation of things. For one, I don't think we value our parents enough. We don't realise their worth, because I never ever wanted to let my mum and dad down. Mm. And Caribbean parents as well are very, very strict. Up until the day my mum and my dad died, they never heard me swear. You know, so I would always have manners and respect to her and my mum. My mum was my queen, my dad was my king. Then they've gone. And I come from a state in Batsy called Dunstan Road Estate, where a few naughty boys there. And when I was growing up, you know when you're a sportsman, people don't really want to be around you that much, right? Because they want to smoke, they want to drink, they want to get birds and whatever. And I wasn't involved in all that. So they would go certain places and not invite me and like half mug me off.
Did you see it all going on though? Was it very close? You knew what was going on?
Yeah, I knew what was going on. I would hang around with the boys, but I wouldn't get involved in anything, because I knew then that I was a strong character, because I wouldn't smoke and I wouldn't drink at all. Always wanted to play small. when they went, the boys who used to try it and half bully me, I started turning the tables on them. And then I never had no money. And then I started doing things to get money. And it just started escalating from there.
What was your sporting career looking like at this stage? So you're 17, but you've been, obviously you've been a top footballer in your area. You're playing for the district, close to playing for the county?
Playing for the district. I had trials at clubs. I had two trials at Crystal Palace, one at Millwall. Just never got in, telling me that I'm too small. That's when I got into Guinness. Because you know then, they'll be like, drink Guinness, it make you bigger and all that. So I used to drink the Guinness punch. My mum used to make it up for me. And I just could not get in. Every team I played for, the manager would be like, you're the best player. My school teacher, Mr. Airy, bought me my first pair of football boots in primary school. I remember him like it was yesterday. He was all about sport. He's from New Zealand. Cricket, football, athletics. And he always thought, you're going to be special, son. And then secondary school, we had a team called Larkle Phoenix, a guy called Pete Rhodes. Even now he calls me the champ. He's like, you're just special. We had a good team, but he was like, you're the best one in the team.
Did you stop playing like as soon as you left school? Or were you still playing?
I know, I'm still playing. I was always playing. Even when I was doing nonsense,
yeah.
I was still playing football. That was my goal.
What
team.
Level was you playing at? Like under 16, under 17?
Under 16, we never had under 16. We went straight into men's football at that age. You know what I mean? And I went to a school called Sir Walter St. John's. So I went to a team called Old St. John's, which was an old boys team. And I remember a guy called John Sackett run the team. So I played my first game, I played at right back. So I played really well. And he's sly, because it's a full team, but he ain't telling the third team, second team, first team about me. He's just keeping me to himself. And this time, I'm starting to get in trouble now. He gets to hear about it. He ends up giving me a job as a training mechanic. So I start working for him. He gets the first team manager's job. First thing he does is bring me with him.
From fourth to the first.
Yeah.
Never been seen before.
So I start playing for them and start doing really well. And he knew, remember Les Briley at Millwall? Wow. He was a centre mid, he was a captain at Millwall. He knew him and ended up getting me a trial there. But at that time, my main focus were on football. And obviously, later on, I got to realise what you needed to do to get it, to make it as a pro footballer. I never done myself justice at Millwall and never got that. Then I started offending even more. And then I got arrested when I was 19 and then went to prison for the first time.
At those trials that you mentioned, did you feel as almost like the pressure was so high because you knew that if you didn't make it as a footballer at this stage, were you potentially going to be into a lot of trouble? Is that how you felt?
I wasn't even thinking about that at that time. I was thinking, right, a survival at this minute in time. If I get in, I'll get in. But I'm going to have to go on the road anyway and do what I need to do to survive. So I wasn't even thinking about, like, if I don't make it here, this ain't going to happen. I was gone already in my head at that time. It's just a slippery slope for me. And John Sackett had tried everything he could to help me. And I had so many moments in my life with people trying to help me. That's why I knew that I weren't all bad. Otherwise, they would never have helped me.
When you say survival, what do you mean by that?
Never had no money. And without money, you can't eat. And that's how deep it was in the end. You know, like today, if my parents were in Jamaica, I could FaceTime them, I could ring them, whatever. I couldn't do that back then.
Probably quite lucky for you, no?
Yeah.
What you're
yeah,
going up to.
Yeah, listen, the first time I got arrested and I got my sentence, my mum and dad never knew. It's only the second time they knew. It's about writing letters and all that at the time, you know what I mean? Or ring my sister's phone now and again, and that's the only contact you have.
Did your siblings know what was going on, really?
I was living with my sister in Croydon, but I would find myself in Battersea every single day, which is where I come from. And sometimes I miss the last train. And I would have to sleep in the bin cupboard and all that because I couldn't get home. And as I said, my sister never knew nothing. It's only when I started getting arrested, that's when she knew.
You think about it as well. If you'd have even got a contract at Millwall or Palace, whatever it would have been, the money back then wouldn't have been enough probably for you to survive anyway. So you're probably going to still be doing both.
I don't think so, because, you know, they would probably put you in digs.
True.
Yeah, they would probably put you in digs. You'd have had your food covered and all that. And you're going training every day, so the distraction probably wouldn't be there, you know.
When your parents left, did they say anything to you? Did they know?
They wanted me to come. They wanted me to come, but I always wanted to play football. And then they said to me, why don't you go to your uncle's in Canada, which I was going to go. But then, we were talking about sliding doors and that. I was going to go to Canada to live. And I got arrested. I had a stitch-up charge by these plainclothes police. They stitched me and my mates up, said that we was looking in cars and whatever. We weren't doing nothing like that. All my crimes I've admitted to, if I've done wrong. They stitched us up and went to magistrate's court. And I'm thinking, there's no way in this earth they can find me guilty. That's when you realise that magistrate court is their court. You always get found guilty in their court. So I got found guilty. I think I got some community service or something like that. But then I'm not allowed to go to Canada because of criminal record. You're done. So I had to stay, and that's when it just escalated even more.
Could you tell us a little bit about the Dunstan estate where you grew up, and also did the police system, did you feel like it mirrored your upbringing?
The police were awful back then. Like, you know, we knew, especially with plainclothes, we knew the registrations, LHX was the last three letters, and DHR, I still remember them now. So if we saw them, we are off. You know what I mean? Because they will find something to pin on you. But our estate, I loved my estate. And to the point, like, all my childhood friends, we still meet once a month and have dinner. All the way through my career, no matter where I was, I made sure that they come and watch games, because they shared all the downtimes where every prison I went to, they came and visited. So they got to share the good times as well.
You have a cage on the estate?
Like, yeah, we had two. The other side, there was rubbish over the other side.
Did you play against them or not?
Yeah, they were rubbish though.
There's so many players that come out of the estates by just playing cage football.
But you've seen a couple of my posts. Cage football is so important. You know, like, even little things for us, like, we play against the elders. You don't want to be last pick.
Yeah.
You get kicked down on concrete, scrape your legs up. Don't cry unless you won't be able to play again. And it just toughens you up.
Yeah.
You know? Nowadays, they're on 4G. I mean, early doors, kids of 5, 6 complaining about pitches. We played on dog shit park. Even in the Premiership, our training ground was a joke.
Yeah.
I think there's too much cotton wool wrapped around these kids nowadays. I loved playing in the cage, and I'd be there from morning till nighttime until my mum called me. And then I would have to run. We had this thing. If I heard James, I would have to run and I would have to beat her in. Otherwise, I'm getting it.
And you're not getting dinner.
No, I don't really get dinner.
Yeah, I'd have to go straight away.
And that's the discipline what's missing in today's society. You know? Yeah.
How did your parents discipline you then?
Mate, we used to get beaten, and I don't see nothing wrong with it, to tell you the truth. Like, but there was tears of beatings. Like, if you're just bad, get the slipper, and they send you for the slipper. Then there's the belt, and then there's a curtain wire, which top tier beating, and they would send it to you. That was the worst part about it. You've got to go and get your weapon that you're going to get beaten for.
But could you choose the slipper?
No, you can never choose. You can never choose. They send you what. And you know, sometimes I can't find it. It says, if I find it, you're going to get double.
I can't find the wire, but I've got the slipper, mum. <Yeah. laughs>
It never done me no harm whatsoever. I knew right from wrong.
Your mum actually sent you back out to fight, didn't she?
She used to send me back out to fight. Like, I would come in, if I started coming in with the older boys bullying me, she would walk me out. So go and fight, what am I feeding you for? And she'd stand across the road. And I would have to go and get my hands dirty. You know, so it made me tougher.
Was your dad different in that respect?
My dad was more quiet. He would never do that. But there was an edge about my dad as well. I learned a lot from my dad. He was very quiet. I'm the same as my dad, but I'm a bit more aggressive than my dad.
At 19, you're sentenced to 3 years for robbery, assault and theft. Huh. Your parents had left 2 years prior to this. Do you remember the last time you spoke to them before this happened and this snowballed?
Nah, I couldn't even remember speaking to them on the regular because I wasn't at my sister's and they would ring my sister's. I was always outside doing nonsense in Battersea all the time. And I remember when I got arrested as well. Like, police come to my house. They kept on coming to my house because I robbed my local snooker what I used to play at. And out of my crimes, that was the one I regretted the most. Because there's a guy, Bob, who was the manager there. And we was close at the time. And he actually caught me doing what I was doing. He's going, just put it back, Jay. And I think through embarrassment, I beat him up and took it. And I was out drinking the night before, and that's why I don't drink white rum no more. The white rum got me, and I lost my head. I'd done what I'd done, and they was on me for a little while. Then I got arrested, I knew. They let me out and said, come back tomorrow. And I've gone court the next day. They said, oh, come back after lunch. And you know, once they say come back after lunch, you know you're going to prison.
It was hardly the most mastermind of crimes either, mate.
I was rubbish at it. I was rubbish at crime. That's what I got.
It's the one that you used to play in and go to all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you take?
Money.
Money?
Yeah. That's it. And then a couple of my pals were in there and they said, what are you doing? Like, nonsense. And then I got 3 years for that, which I think was harsh. For my first sentence, I think it was massively harsh.
Was it almost a blessing that, like, it could have escalated to even more serious a crime?
Not on that one. Not on that one, no. I thought it was harsh, but I'm glad I got that sentence.
That's what I mean, the fact that you got it.
I'm glad I got that sentence.
Yeah.
But then I went to Dover, they sent me to Dover Prison. That's where I done my sentence. And we was playing teams, we used to go out and play against teams when I was in Dover. And first, I was about 10 stone when I went in there. That's when I started hitting the gym. I remember my pals when I got in there, I couldn't lift 5 kilos on each side. And they're laughing at me. And the way I am as a person, I'm like, all right, cool. Went back to my cell, started doing dips, press-ups. By the time I come out of that sentence, I was the third strongest in the prison. In the powerlifting, I was up there. But I got parole first time because I was a model prisoner. I did not get in no shit in there whatsoever. The screws loved me. I got a distinction in maths. And I'd done City and Gills in mechanics.
I've heard you talk about that first stint and saying you were a model prisoner. In a way, were you lucky the way you were treated? Or was it because of how you were as a person?
No, it's just me as a person. Like, I had so much friends in there as well, like, who were naughty as well. But I never got wrapped up into the gang culture, in wanting to fight people. I wanted to go home. You know what I mean? So I just kept my head down, gym, football, any sport I'd done. And then we have table tennis and we have pool in the evening. So I was well away. I never got into nothing.
What do people not know about prison that you can share with us?
some of the stuff you don't really want to know. Listen, you can find problems if you want to find problems. Like, you'll see people getting hot water and sugar poured all over them, people getting stabbed up in there. But if you keep yourself to yourself, you can be all right in there. And a lot of people learn stuff in there, but you also learn how to be a better gangster as well. You know what I mean? Because you make friends in there and they're into the criminal stuff. But I was just like, nah, it's not for me. Even though I know a lot of the boys and all that.
Did you have to make a statement at the start?
No, that was on my second sentence.
Okay.
And my first sentence, I never, because I knew so many people. And a lot of my people, they knew what I was like. If it come to me, then I would have to look after myself. But it never, ever came to me.
It just sounds like people look out for you because they, like the teachers that you mentioned as well, they knew that you could move forward with football, possibly.
Yeah, that's what everyone in, especially, you see, young offenders is worse than men's prison because everyone's still trying to prove themselves as they're walking around like a peacock and all that, trying to prove. But for some reason, everyone liked me, you know, and just let me get on with what I was getting on with.
Where did you two meet?
Where was it? In Galoo.
Yeah, it's a restaurant.
But we obviously know of each other anyway, because of the football industry.
Yeah, I actually had a look to see if we ever actually played against each other. And there's a couple of times where like I was sub and Jamie started, or I started and Jamie was sub, and we was on the pitch for a little period of time. Yeah. So we did cross over in our playing careers as well. But, you know, our areas are not too far away when I was living in London. So there was a restaurant that we used to go to, and Jamie used to frequent that quite often.
Yes, I was living right opposite, so I could look right in there. If it's busy, I'll go down.
What's your view on the prison system at the moment?
Prison system, shocking. You got prison officers who are in the job for the wrong reasons. Like, if I was in prison now, what I went through, it wouldn't happen again, never. For one, there's too much red tape in prison as well. And then they're not looking to make the prisoners better. They're just doing it for a job and to get a good pension or whatever. Come on, man, prison's a joke now. Like, even that, having TV in your cell and all that, there's nothing to put you off prison no more. Like, I had 23, I bang out some prisons I went to. You had to slop out. You had to do shit like that. So you're thinking, I don't even want to come back. I mean, they got everything in there now. They're sending emails and all that.
Too easy.
Yeah, I think it's too easy.
But after you got out the first time, it wasn't long before you were back inside. You took that maths diploma with you.
Distinction. Yeah,
distinction, maths, all the skills you had.
Yeah.
What happened? Could you apply for a job?
Nah, when you come out of prison, no one ain't going to employ you. Like, you go for a job, what's the first thing they ask you? Have you got a criminal record? You say no, they might give it to you, then later down the line they make their checks and then they sack you anyway. You tell them, yeah, I've got a criminal record, they're not going to employ you. And who's going to, would you employ someone who's just come out of prison? There's many few who would, you know what I mean? Obviously depending on what they've gone there for. But there's not a lot of people out here will give people a criminal a chance. So I've come out. There's a story behind it. The person I got arrested for, we had a long, long history of not liking each other. So when I was away, he was bullying one of my friends. So I've come home now. And we've seen him. So I said to my mate, let's do this. My friend started fighting him, weren't doing too clever. I've jumped in, started beating him up. He's tried to run off, caught him, beat him up, robbed him, took all his gold and whatever. But for weeks later, he was driving around saying that he's going to kill me. So like, I take them sort of threats serious, especially where I come from. So I knew that he was going to work this day. And I've plotted up, he's come out of his house, and I've jumped out and I said, yeah, you're looking for me, yeah? He's run off, he's actually called the police. A few days later, my friend got arrested. And then I was staying at my friend's house. The next day they've come round there. They have, I've looked out the window, the plainclothes are everywhere. So there's one room I stay in. They've come in. I've gone into another room. They've searched this room and not searched anywhere else. So I knew that he's grasped on me, my friend. But he denied it and denied it. So I was on the run for about 6 weeks. And it come to a head and all that. Like, when you're on the run, you can't work. What do you do? Crime to survive. And then you're going to get further and further into getting a bigger sentence.
You say on the run, you're still in London.
I'm still in London.
It's only a matter of time, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And you're going to get caught doing something else as well. And so I see them and they're like, in the end, I just give myself in. And I went straight on my mum because I broke my parole as well, because I'd only been out 3 months. And now going to big man's prison, Wormwood Scrubs. And I don't care who you are, like, when you're going to men's prison, you are shitting yourself. And I was like, fucking hell, I've really done it now. So I remember going into Scrubs, and that's another good thing for me. I knew a lot of people in there who actually looked out for me. But my mum came over when I was in Scrubs. And that's the only time I cried in prison. Because she's come over, she's gone to my sister, where's my son? She's gone, he's in prison. She's come up on a visit. She's crying. Why have you done this to me, son? And I'm just fucking crying my eyes out because me and my mum are close. Me and my dad are close. I just felt like I let them down. And I was like, and this time I've not been sentenced or nothing. So I'm going not guilty on this case anyway, because for one, I wanted to see if he grasped, if he will grasp, if he will go up in the dock. And I was thinking that the guy, what we'd done, might drop the charges as well, because he knew the rules of the street. He used to think he was a gangster. But as time went on, then get moved to Brixton, and then it's a trial at Kingston Crown Court. Police only wanted me. They never wanted my mate. They wanted me. So go up for trial. And I've come up from upstairs because I'm on remand, and he's coming. He's on the same charge. There's a screw separating us. He's trying to talk to me, but I know in the back of my head that he's grasped me. After about 3 days, it's a week-long trial, third day, they call him up as a witness. And he's gone in the dock and spilt the beans. He even told them things what weren't to do with the case. And it took them 55 minutes to find me guilty. And then I remember what the judge said to me. He's gone, listen, if you ever come up in front of me again, I will lose you in the system. Give me 4 years.
I've heard you say that before. What does he mean by that?
Well, I will get a big sentence. Not like four, is it? A little sentence. But he's talking like 10, 12 or something like that.
Do you remember what that conversation was like with your mum? What was said? What was shared? You hadn't seen her for a while, right?
Yeah, I hadn't seen her for a while. What, on a visit?
Yeah.
No, she's just like, why have you done this to me? We brought you up better than this. And she did. I could never have had any better upbringing than what my mum and dad gave me. Like, I saw my mum doing two jobs a day, and my dad leaving at 5 o'clock in the morning, coming 7 o'clock in the evening.
Would that have been the last thing she had expected? Was there no reason for her to think that you'd have gone down that road?
No, definitely. Because I never gave her no cause to think that I would go down that road. Listen, my mum, yeah. She had worked all them hours, God sent. She always had this retirement plan of going back to Jamaica to retire in the sun and with my other siblings and all that. So my mum never deserved no guilt. She gave me all the tools in life to run with.
Was there a lasting message, though, that stayed with you that helped moving forward?
What, from my mum? Ah, my mum, listen, the only thing that she would have said is don't let that your past define you. And that's what stood me in good stand later on in my career. You always, listen, you either lose or you learn, right? And I learned a lot from every situation I was in.
Camp Hill Prison in the Isle of Wight at 21. Yeah, so what was different there?
because the prison what I went for, it was 4 years, I was in 4 years. For my sentence, it was the hardest prison for my sentence. It's a prison for people with violence on their record and people for drugs. So I knew at this point that I know someone's going to test me, for one. And I was scared of going into this prison because the Isle of Wight is where they send all the bad prisoners. Because for your visits, it's hard. It's a day trip, you know what I mean, for your visits. So when I got in there, I'm like, I've really done it now. And I remember going, like, you go on an induction wing for a week. And then they put you on all these different wings. And then I get put on to Thomas's, which was at the top of the prison. So you got four in a cell. And they happened to put me in a cell with a guy from my area as well. So luckily. But then we used to play table tennis and all that, and then you had to put your name up for a phone. So my name's at the top. It's a Saturday. Come out, this guy who's a wing bully, I remember his name, Tullock. He's rubbed my name out in front of me. I'm going, what are you doing? He's gone, be quiet unless I do you. So I'm going, well, we better get this on, right? So I've gone, just got a table tennis room. And I've got my mate outside the door, keeping dog. And I've ended up knocking him clean out. He's out cold on the chair like that. But I've broke my hand on him, this one here now. So like, obviously it don't take no much working out. He's knocked out and my hand's smashed to bits. They've nicked me, but my hand's broken, so they have to take me to the hospital. They've took him down the block as well. I've come back, they've took me to the block. And he ends up grassing me up saying that I started shit. He gets shipped out of the prison because now he's a grass, right? I had to have an operation on my hand. They take me to Parkhurst, which is the most notorious prison in England at the time. I had to go there for a week. And this was a point where I'm thinking, I'm walking past these cells, 30 years, 35 years, 20 something years. That's a wake up call. You know what I mean? I'm doing little 4 years. I'm going to be out on the road soon. But after I come back to my wing, the screws were happy. They never liked him. Right? So I lost my 7 days, but I ended up getting them back in the end. And then after that, I never got no more problems.
Was that like the moment where you felt like you was getting tested? You could either back down or you had to front it, and that was what you did?
Yeah, had to. But my mum. Yeah. My mum come back to me, you know what I mean? You can't melt. You've got to confront it, even if you lose. Because you know bullies, that if you fight a bully, they don't want to fight.
As soon as he's rubbed your name out, you're thinking, oh, here we go.
Yeah, this is I knew straight away.
Because you weren't going to back down. You thought,
I wasn't backing down. Don't care. I'm not backing down. You might beat me, but you're going to have to earn it.
When did the football side of being in prison start for you?
So I've obviously my hand healed now, and we have in wing competitions in there, which is like, I think you win about £7 for your canteen, which is big money in there. You can buy your biscuits and your Mars bars and your tuna fish and corn and whatever. So they've gone to me because they see me play and they're like, do you want to play in a wing competition there? My winger never won it. So, yeah, of course I'll play. We ended up winning it, and I'm playing well. Then every year they played a team called Cal Sports on Boxing Day. They picked me for the team and that. Do you remember Ambrose Mendy?
Yeah.
Nigel Benn's manager and Paul Ince, he was in prison with me. So I play against Cal's. I scored 2 goals. I scored a worldie top corner, and then I score a header in about 80-something minute, and we win 3-2. And then they gone to the gaffer, gone to the prison officer. Is there any chance we can get him out to play for us? And they told me. But after the game, Ambrose Mendy has come up to me. He's gone, listen, I'm coming out soon. I'm going to keep an eye on your progress. I thought he was chatting shit. Because you know a lot of people, they chat shit. But I had only done about a year at the time of my sentence. And my parole is after 16 months, a year and 4 months, when you're doing four. So I knew they weren't going to let me out every weekend before that. I would get knocked back on my parole, go on home leave and come back, and then I'd build up the trust. So I've gone on home leave, come back, and the prison officer has gone to me, Mr. Walder. I shouldn't even ever call him prison officer because he's not that to me. Mr. Walder, always. And the governor of the prison said, yeah, you can go out every weekend. First, Mr. Walder had to take me, and then they allowed Dal Young, the manager, to come and get me. And then I was playing every week, having a few guineas after the game and all that, giving me mints as well, so they wouldn't smell it. But the screws knew. Yeah. They knew. They just, I was no problems whatsoever.
Did you have any boots at this stage or not?
Yeah, they bought me boots. The prison, Mr. Walder bought me football boots.
Brilliant.
That's so nice. Do you remember what they were?
Mizuno's. They're in one of my pictures, yeah, Mizuno's it was.
So this is the officer, I shouldn't Mr. say officer, Walder. That saved your life.
Mr. Walder said. Saved my life. And Dal saved my life. And the governor, because, listen, let's have it right. Yeah. They put their job on the line for me. Because if I go out, I might run off, I might abscond. I might fight on the pitch. And their job's up in the air. They put their jobs on the line for me. And I was like, and he always says it on podcasts, Mr. Walder. He said, he just knew that I was different. Because even when they're playing in the wing competition, just imagine you're playing it in the wing competition. There's no rules. I don't even think they had a whistle. I'm getting kicked from pillow to post because I'm the best player in there. And everyone wants a £7 canteen. So I'm getting kicked left, right and centre. I will not retaliate. I'll be like, give me the ball again. I'm going past you.
Before the inter-wing competition, is football done in your head? Are you thinking like, I'm not even thinking about playing football at all at the minute?
I was thinking I'm done. I thought my life as being a footballer was finished. And then when, after the inter-wing competition and they started letting me out every week, Dal Young started writing to clubs, started getting GMTV, do you remember GMTV? They come into the prison. Done an interview with me, Daily Mail, The Standard.
Little celeb in there, yeah?
Yeah, and they let me out to go and do a radio show. So it was mad, and that could have worked one or two ways in there. You could have had prisoners resenting you, but every single one of them were loving what I was doing. And I had one of my good friends, I have to give him a mention, Mickey Bowman. What a guy. He comes from my area. And he had the place on lockdown, and he just looked out for me big time. And then the rest of the prisoners looked out for me. And they give me a job in the gym as well, which helped. I was training 6 times a day, minimum. I was doing 3 football sessions, an hour each, gym sessions, and then I'd do a circuit.
What level are Cal Sports at this stage when you're going out?
It's semi-pro. Probably, I don't even know the steps or whatever they are now. It's probably a step 3 club.
You finding it easy as well?
Yeah. And they get like, when I first started, it was about 200-300. Then it went up to about 600 fans and all that. And because obviously I'm probably fitter than all of them because I'm training all the time. But I found it easy.
Did you find you had to develop quickly as a footballer?
No,
you've talked about Millwall this.
I was always developed, like, and this is what I think that they take from the game now. We had to work it out for ourselves. They don't know more. Like, I'm very clever in my mind, especially sport, whatever. I can work things out very
find
quickly.
A way to what you've got, your attributes to
100% like in my career I've had nights where I thought, nothing ain't happening for me. Tony DiRigo gave me the biggest lesson of my career. But then I went away and I'm thinking, how do I beat it? And that's how I was from a kid, like every sport, I found a way.
You mentioned having multiple sessions in the prison. Your football sessions, what did they look like?
So you had a job in prison, so everyone would have an hour slot of football. Because I worked in the gym, I could join. That's why they gave me the job. I can join in every single session. So I'll play, they would have two teams. I would join three of the football sessions. Then I would go in the gym, do my weights, do two of them. And then I'd do a circuit in my cell, either at night time or before my cellmates wake up in the morning. Because I had a little inkling, because Dale was right into clubs, I had a little inkling that I might still make it. And it weren't going to be for the want of trying that I wouldn't make it.
And you're released on parole after just over 2 years, is that right? And this is during pre-season, which is nice.
Yeah, they were so clever in the way that they'd done everything, right? They gave me a knockback on my first parole, and then you're up again in 6 months for your parole again. And they gave me parole, but they gave me parole in pre-season. So I go from prison straight on trial. So Ambrose Tweeds kept his word, got me a trial at Southend. He rung the prison. So the TV cameras, when I got let out, they're waiting. I've come out, they followed me to the ferry. Next day, they followed me to Southend. And I'll tell you who's there then, Chris Powell.
Pally.
Yeah, Brett Angel.
Pally at Charlton for...
Yeah, I'd ledge. Yeah.
Great guy, Pally.
Brett Angel, Ricky Otto, Keith Jones. There's some big hitters. Andy Anser, a good friend of mine. Big hitters there. And one thing I've got to say about them boys took care of me because I was travelling from South London to Southend. And them boys would give me a lift to somewhere so I can get a train. And we became good friends after. But I never got nothing there. Barry Fry and Edwin Steen were the coaches. And as much as I thought I was fit, I weren't football fit. I mean, I'm lifting where pre-season as well was brutal back then. I remember running on the beach and I'm thinking, is this what you've got to do to be a professional footballer? And I'm like... But I weren't quitting, but I'm thinking, this is tough, you know what I mean? But when you ain't got no one to teach you about pre-season or whatever.
It's your first one, and how old are you now?
23.
23, first pre-season. It's an eye-opener, isn't it?
Massive eye-opener. So I stayed there for a month, not got nothing. And it's an intimidating place to be, in a change room. Like, the confidence as well. Am I good enough? I mean, these people have been doing it for their whole life.
There's also people in the dressing room that don't want to see a new lad coming in. 100%. You might play exactly the same position as them and everything. Hang about, who's this?
100%. Fizzing balls into you and all that, you know what I mean?
Was it up
leaving
to you?
You short. Yeah?
Sorry, I was going to say, was it up to you then to tell them your story or were they already aware?
Nah, they were aware. It was on the TV. They're well aware of it straight away. And that's what I'm glad. I've never hid it anyway. But I was glad they were aware of it. But I never got nothing there. Then I went Millwall. I was there for a month. And I actually thought I'd done enough to get a contract at Millwall. Then I went to Wimbledon. They tried to offer me about £200 a week to stay. And then I went up to Sunderland. And in hindsight, I think that was the best thing that I could have ever done. Because it got me away from London. And I became a man overnight. I went there on a Monday. No, I went there Sunday. Terry Butcher was manager. He's a legend, by the way. I went there on the Sunday, trained Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Played against Leeds on Thursday. And you know when you played well. Played really, really well, but you still ain't been told that you're going to get signed. Next day, Friday, Terry Butcher's called me in the office. Go and sit down, son. He's gone, you excite me, I'm going to sign you. He said, go back to London, get your stuff, spend some time with your family. We've got Leicester next week, Then you come back on a coach, you play in that game, come back on a coach, and then we'll assign you. And then played against Leicester, gone back on a coach. And then I signed on a Friday, and then I made my debut live on ITV on the Sunday against Middlesbrough.
When a former England captain is believing in you that much, does that give you that unbelievable belief that maybe I do belong here?
100%. 100%. But then, you know how football is. It can turn in a heartbeat, can't it? He got sacked probably about 2-3 months after me being there. Killed me. Because some guy called Mick Buxton took over. Flat cap man from Barnsley. Never liked me. He was a reserve team manager and never liked me. I probably weren't doing myself any favours because I was living that life. I was enjoying the football life, going out, enjoying the birds and all that. But in the running, I'd still be up there. I'd still be winning the running. But he just never liked me. It just made it impossible for me to stay.
For those that might not be aware then, could you describe your style, position in football terms? What were you like at this point?
I was a winger who wanted to take people on. I love taking people on. And I had the pineapple on my head at the time as well, which up there as well. It's funny, like, it's like they've never seen a black man before. Like, I've been going out and all that, and like, can we touch your hair and all that? I'm like, fucking hell. But listen, I enjoyed it up there, and it's always going to have a special place in my heart, Sunderland, because the fans, right, fans talk to me, and they got right behind me. They knew the story, and they never cared. Probably a good club to be, coming from where I come from, because they're all working class people and they understand how it goes.
Did you get sick of the questions at some point?
Nah, because you know what? I've always looked at things. My story can influence someone else, you know? So I always try and use my story to influence people. People go through hard times in life and you've got to make them know that no matter how low you are today, tomorrow can be better.
You signed for Sunderland on your mum's birthday. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it was massive. Like, my mum's birthday, my dad's birthday's around that, and my sister's birthday. And then I made my debut a couple of days later, where I came on a sub, and then I made my home debut against Luton at Roker Park on the Tuesday. I know she's proud of me. She's proud of me anyway, my mum. And I knew that's a special moment for her and my dad as well. My dad was one of those, you know, dads, they don't really show it, do they? My mum would show it and my sister would show it.
You said there that Terry Butcher ended up getting the sack. How did things change for you at Sunderland after that?
Right, Terry Butcher, we're speaking off air about man management and all that. Terry Butcher understood that I came from prison, right? I'm not going to get everything right at the beginning, but it would help me. I remember the first pre-match, you know, you had to put down, what is it, eggs, chicken or whatever, yeah? And he's asked me, what do you want for pre-match? I said, chips and something. He said, you can't have that, son.
You're like, learning, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm learning on the job. But then Mick Buxton come in, and you're meant to know everything. And that weren't quite working with me. To the point that I'm like, can't play under him. My nephew was in hospital. I was injured. I'd done my ankle. And I've gone into him. And it took a lot for me to go in and ask a manager anything. And I've gone in, I'm like, listen, my nephew's ill. Can I have some time off? He's gone to me, you've got one day. Look, you know, like Sunderland, by the time you come down here, you've got to turn back around and go. Family's everything for me. So I've took 10 days off, come back. He's fined me 2 weeks' wages. And that's when I'm like, you kind of lost me. He never rated me as a player. So Ian Atkins, who was Terry Butcher's number two, had got the job at Doncaster. So I rung him. I said, Atky, any danger of you coming and getting me? He's put a 20 grand bid in for me. They've accepted it. Gone there now.
What level is this, Joe?
League two now, the bottom league.
So you've taken a drop just because you want to go and play?
I want to go and play. And this is what I would say to youngsters. Sometimes you've got to take a step back to play. I mean, you never know how good you can unless you do play. Yeah. So I've gone there. He got the sack as well.
Something's happening here.
It's Jamie Lawrence.
Oh, mate, I'm like, I keep getting people the sack. But life is so funny like this. Like, a guy called Sammy Chung got the job. He don't know me. I've only played about 8 games at this time. No one don't know you about 8 games. I win all the running when I get back. And then we got a game the next day against the semi-pro side. I score one, I make one. Him and his assistant, George Smith, have called me in the office the next day. I think I'm in trouble. He sat me down and gone, what do you want to do with your career? I want to play in the Prem. He's gone, you've got all the tools to play in the Premier League. And from there, every team talk, get the ball out to Jamie. Jamie, take people on, get crosses in the box. And this is what I'm talking about, man management. He made me feel about 10 foot tall. And then by transfer deadline, I was in London, get a call from my agent, Barry Siltman, Leicester want to sign you. That's 10 months after being at leaving Sunderland, 17 months after coming out of prison. And we go out the next day. And that's what, you see, when I went to Doncaster, my motivation is proving Mick Buxton wrong. Yeah, I'm going to prove you wrong. All right, get rid of me, prove you wrong. And then went up to Leicester, signed the next day, 300 grand, Mark McGee signed me. And then made my debut against Man City, I think the following week.
So let's get this right. 17 months after you leave prison, you're in the Premier League.
I'm playing in the Premier League. Never been coached up until 23. And I'm in the Premier.
That's crazy.
I said to Jamie off air, I said, this is something that would never happen again. You won't hear anything like this ever again. And obviously the fella that let you go from Sunderland, what was the fee for that?
20 grand. So you've done yourself out of 280. Yeah. And this is why them sort of managers have no place in football. I think you get more out of anyone by getting to know them personally.
Do you think not coming through an academy and not being sort of man-managed through your game and say, I want you to do this and don't do this and don't do that, because you must have been like off the cuff, a little bit of a free spirit. Did that help you, you think, as a winger?
I think that helped me because I was so things myself and I was free, like I wanted to take people on. And you know, back then as well, coaches wanted you to take people on. If I never took someone on, I'm coming off. So they allowed me to do certain things, especially at Donny. Just get on with it. Go and express yourself. And then when I went to Leicester, Mark McGee, it's a different level then, isn't it? You know, Premier League's different level. It's a holy grail.
Did you have a welcome to the Premier League moment?
I remember playing against Julian Dix. I know what's coming, isn't it? Like, I've gone past him a couple of times and that. And he smashed me. And I got up and started laughing. And you laughing at you? I'm like, you. Next challenge, smashed him. Once you do that, they kind of know.
Well, obviously, I played fullback, and you would get certain wingers that you knew if you give them a bit early, they might go missing.
Yeah.
But that'll probably.
And you was allowed the one early, weren't you?
You didn't even get a booking. So, I mean, back in the day, it was even worse than obviously my era. Yeah. But you used to get a bit of a freebie. So if you had a chance to take the ball and a lot of the winger,
make a statement.
You'd make a statement. You'd take that opportunity. But some wingers like Jamie probably thrived on that, and he even made it.
Listen. I played prison football. This is nothing.
And the cage.
Yeah. I'm getting paid for this. I mean, so you're not going to be intimidating me. And I like them centre-backs, them left-backs, more than the ones like Tony Dorigo wouldn't let you feel him, wouldn't leave space in behind them, clever, you know what I mean? And they'll run you the other way and all that. So the physical ones, that was right down my street.
It sounds like it was physical. You've obviously got the story. So did you hear anything on the pitch now and again? What would opponents say to you?
They wouldn't say nothing to me. My debut when I made Earson Park, they actually played Jailhouse Rock over the time. And I remember Kevin Ball?
Yeah.
He was our captain. And he put it in a programme. I read it the other day. He's like, I'm not happy that they played Jailhouse Rock to Jamie and coming up. But I didn't care.
Yeah.
I just smile. Like, I think it's good banter.
Your story's your story, isn't it? Yeah. You ain't no hiding from it.
No, I'm not hiding from that, man. I'm proud of the way I turned it around.
You've had another one of our guests, Luke, that's played for Martin O'Neill. We've had a few on now. Yeah. You've got some hairdryer stories, haven't you?
Yeah, Martin took over from Mark McGee. Mark McGee, listen, he signed me. I got on all right with Mark, but I weren't playing every week, and then Martin took over. And I remember the first day he took over, we was playing at Oldham away. And he's called everyone down to the restaurant on a Friday. And he's gone, the first thing he says is, anyone want a drink? And I'm like, it's just geezer on the wind out. Is it a test? And I'm like, I'll have a Guinness. And then a few of the boys are. And he would allow that as long as he performed. And then he sent all the boys to bed. But it's like, you ain't going to bed. I want to know about your story. Because I think he's done psychology or something back in the day. He just wanted to get to know what my story was. And then I went out to bed, and then I wasn't doing myself no favours at the beginning of my career. I was travelling from London to Leicester, and something's going to go on, especially when you're driving. You're going to be late now and again. And I would go missing sometimes. And we got into the playoffs. We got Crystal Palace in the final, but I'd been missing for 10 days. I was ringing up going like I was ill. And Martin don't suffer that. He's not stupid one little bit. So like, we've all got our suits. I tried to slip back in without him noticing. He's called me outside. He's gone, listen, get your suit and fuck off. I do not want to see you until next season. I think now, you know, all summer, I'm thinking, have I got a future here? And good of his word, he's not judged me when I've gone back. He's not said a word. He just wants to see how I act. And I'm doing all right. Pre-season's going well. And then we're going away to an army camp. We had to be there at 12 o'clock. I'll get on the train. Train is getting there at 12:15. I'll get to the ground. They have gone. And I've got to go all the way to Tor Point, which is near Torquay. So I go the next day. I've gone anyway on my own. I've got the train down there. And he's called me outside. He's gone to me like, oh, what happened? I lied to him. I've gone, the trains were delayed. The next day I'm at lunch, called me outside. He has got every train time printed out. Fucking lying. Fucking proper hair dryer. It's going to be the hard pre-season of your life. I was involved with the first team, reserve team, and the youth team. I was in for about a month straight, no days off.
You've talked there about living in London as well, commuting, going out a lot, drinking, the football culture. It doesn't sound like you had an issue after you left prison for the second time. Did you have to go through any sort of rehab process, or were you just suddenly, I know what I want now and I'm going to do it?
Nah, I never had no rehab. I never needed it. I had football. That was my focus now. And football was enough. Football was all I ever wanted. And listen, people offend because they have nothing to aim for. I had that goal and I was like, nothing weren't going to distract me. Like, obviously, like, if I had my time again, I would have never travelled from London to Leicester. But I was learning on the job. And I never made that mistake again.
But going out never pulled you?
No, we'll go out. Like, it was that culture was going out. Like, we'd go out as a team once a month. And Martin was massive on that, wasn't he? Like, the team were going out. We're all going out, or we're going Bournemouth or whatever. And we was all as one.
When you was going back to London, though, obviously living there, was you still surrounded by the same sort of characters?
Yeah. Listen, and I weren't squeaky clean. Like, I would have fights and whatever, but because, you know, like, you can't just think that your past is not going to catch up with you. Like, they think that you're a footballer now, they can take liberties. So I would have certain things go on, but then later down the line and that. I wouldn't get involved in anything.
Was there jealousy there?
A lot of people never liked me because of the shit I'd done before. You know, and then they wanted to have a pop at me and I weren't going to have it.
But you very much stuck to your roots. You didn't become a Premier League footballer, quote unquote.
No, I was never like that. Like, I got good footballer friends and that, but I was more comfortable around my childhood friends. They keep you grounded, you know, and I love my area. And I used to go to the same pub my dad used to go to before, like Jamaican pub, playing reggae music or whatever. And I used to bring all my football mates, I used to bring them in there. You know, that was my point. I call when I used to come back from up north, straight in there first, and then we go out after.
Just going to say there, so obviously you play for Martin at Leicester, but yeah. you then leave to go to Bradford.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you decide to move up at some stage because you can't keep commute. Cause you had 6 years at Bradford, no?
Yeah, 6 years at Bradford. So, like, Martin offered me a new contract. And he done me a proper favour as well, by the way. He said to me, like, listen, I cannot guarantee you first team football, but I want you to stay. But I also want you to move up. But if you don't want to stay, I'll let you go for 50 grand. Bear in mind, they bought me for 300 grand. And he was true to his word, let me go. And then I moved to Bradford. And then I bought my first house in Leeds. And that's where I found my home. Bradford's my baby.
That's a proud moment for you, buying your first house.
Yeah, definitely. From being there to buying my first house. That house got burgled 5 times.
It's because you was in London. I knew you weren't there.
No, but you know that if you're away for a weekend in a hotel and all that, that's when they used to do it and that. And when I was away with Jamaica and that.
What did they take?
First time, they robbed the house when I was asleep. I come back from a night out with the boys and all that. I'm conked out. I wake up in the morning and I'm like, a neighbour's knocking on the door, are you right? And I'm like, I'm sweet, this your leather jacket's on the lawn. And I'm like, okay. So I come back in, and I'm looking around, my hi-fi's gone, PlayStation's gone, and a few other bits are gone, and then I look outside and my car's gone. And I'm like, they've loaded up the car with my goods.
Get it back?
Nah, the car's gone.
How do you process that? As someone who's been in prison before?
I think that's the lowest crime that anyone can do. That's one crime I would never do, go into someone's house. The trauma, especially for a woman as well, that knowing that you've been in their house and all that, I think that's the scummiest thing you could ever do. There's little things I used to do. I used to pretend that I'm going out and I'd jump over the fence and sit in the dark waiting for people and that. I was desperate to catch her.
I imagine retaliation was up there for you. But are you glad that you weren't able to do that?
Yeah, very glad.
What would have happened if they'd have come back?
We can't say that on camera.
I vividly remember that Bradford-Liverpool game because it was only a year after I'd started watching football on Match of the Day when you stayed up on the final day. Yeah, how tough was that year?
The gaffer tucked me up early doors. We went to Highbury and played me right back to play against Henri first. Because remember when he first came, he played left wing.
Yeah.
Then he come off, put over Mars. And I'm like, look at the gaffer, you ratted up me up today, by the way. We got the biggest 2-0 battering ever.
How was Thierry, though? Tell us more.
Well, mate, Thierry was unbelievable. Even then, you just knew. And he hadn't hit his stride yet, but he was unbelievable. He's taller than you think as well, by the way, but quick, strong, and technique on point. He knocked the ball past me in the first 2 minutes, and I'm thinking, this is going to be a long night. And it was. Like, Vieira and Petit and all that as well, what team they had.
You had to stop and think that who you were playing against as well.
Not at the time, I never had enough time to think about it. I was just getting terrorised.
You're just enjoying every game, James, like thinking like, this is unbelievable, it's incredible, I'm loving this.
And I wouldn't overthink as well. I'm not overthinking when it comes to football. I'll be like, I'm going to prove that I should be on this stage. Yeah, and that's what I've done.
Favourite player you played against?
And Omri's my favourite, the best player I played against in the international state, R9.
So this was Jamaica, Brazil?
Yeah. Yeah, we got beat 1-0, but I'll take that before kickoff.
Remember, you just get off the coach sometimes, and someone will say, like, Old Trafford, take two now, and the boys will be like, Yeah,
all day long.
Can you set that day up for us then? How many caps in were you at this point with Jamaica?
I don't know how many caps I was in at the time, but it's 2003, and I remember I was at Walsall, and Merce was there, and Merce is the biggest wind up ever. He's going, "You Jamaicans can't play football. You're going to get beat about 7-0. And in my head, you know me, I'm like, I'm not getting beat 7-0 because he ain't going to stop if I go back and get beat 7-0.
World champions, right?
Well, there was world champions at the time. And remember, they had Kaká, Rivaldo, Carlos, Cafu, Lucio, Rocco Jr., Gilberto Silva. They had Adriano on the bench. I'm glad that Ronaldinho was injured as well, by the way.
Where did you play that match?
I played holding mid.
Was it in Jamaica or?
No, it was at Walker Stadium, Leicester.
That's crazy. What was the crowd like?
It was a sellout, but the crowd was wicked because Jamaica, Brazil, everyone loves Jamaica and everyone loves Brazil, so what an atmosphere that was.
Was that the proudest part of your career, playing your country? And obviously you go back every year, right, to visit your family at the time? Yeah,
at the time. But I was obviously going to Jamaica all the time because I'm getting called up. My favourite time playing for Jamaica is making my debut and having my mum in the stand watching me. I used to make sure someone picked her up where she lived, bring her to the stadium so she could watch. I think that was her proudest moment as well. I had got called up for Jamaica when my dad was on his deathbed. So me making my debut, he had died before then, so me making my debut was for him, really.
Do you remember telling your parents that you were called up?
My dad was on his deathbed when he got called up, and I brought him over to England to see if there's any more we could do for him. And I got called up. They also withdrew the invitation because of my criminal past. But then the Jamaica public kicked up a stink and said, well, he's done his time, allow him to come back. And then the president of the Football Federation has flown over from Jamaica and has come to the hospital and told my dad on his deathbed that I would represent Jamaica. So he died proud.
Thanks for sharing that, Jamie. You were there at the time, I'm assuming, as well.
Yeah, I was there, yeah. That's what, even the Liverpool game, leading up to the Liverpool game, that was a tough time as well, because I had the phone call. I'd been injured as well for about 5 weeks. I'd broken my jaw both sides, and the gaffer got me back. I played 20 minutes a week before against Leicester, and he's like, "I want you to play this week. I need you badly." And on the Wednesday leading up to the Sunday game, I had a call from Jamaica that dad's got cancer, he's dying. Then I went into Paul Joel, said to the gaffer, "Gaffer, don't think I can play in this game." And he's gone, "Do it for your dad." And then on that Sunday, I played like a man possessed in that. 1-1-0, come in the change room. Gaffer's done me up, he's come over and he's whispering my ear, "That's for your dad. Done me." Tears coming down my eyes and that.
And at this point, you hadn't told anyone else, right?
I hadn't told none of the boys. Even spoke to John Dreyer the other day, Tumble. And he said, "Jam, I just watched one of your documentaries and I never even knew you was going through that." I said, "No one needed to know."
Said to you this before, in dressing rooms, you don't really know what the other lads are going through. No, no one really talks out or speaks out. It's just about the game and trying to win a game of football at the weekend, isn't
it? 100%.
But at that point where you break down, do people then start asking you what's wrong?
Could we do a lap of honour as well? And they're not asking me, but I spoke to a couple of the boys, my closest boys. I told them, but I had to go. Obviously, dad passed away not long after that. I think it's about 5-6 weeks. and then I'll go to Jamaica to bury him.
Did it change in any way how you saw the game?
No, it's a release. And I've never shared this on camera before, but I never knew, I never found out my dad was my real dad until he was on his deathbed, which killed me. Yeah, really killed me. I'd buried someone before who I thought was my dad. Then when he was on his deathbed, I got told that he's my real dad, and that killed me.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
What would you like to say? How did that all evolve, Jamie?
No, because when the president of the Football Federation came over, he came over as a reporter. And then I must have said to him, yeah, my stepdad is dying. And then my sister has pulled me and said, it's not your stepdad, it's your real dad. And I remember that's where Iron Apple comes into it. I just got up and I was like, said to my mates, listen, I need to get away for a weekend. We went to Iron Apple. And when I come back, same day I came back, my dad had passed away. It's a tough time.
What did you learn about all of that in the aftermath then? How did your sister know this before you?
Listen, I don't know how she knew it before me, but and I would never. Mum, they done it for a reason, right? And I would. My mum was still here. I never ever asked my mum why they done it, because I wouldn't want to put that on my mum. There's a reason. My mum would always protect me. There's a reason why they done it. So, in the end, as much as it hurt, I never wanted to hurt my mum. So I never asked a question.
Well, thank you for sharing it. Has it affected or impacted how you parent? You've got four children, is that right?
Oh, yeah, four children from three different mothers. Listen, the way you parent nowadays, I think, is different than when they parented. I think they were better parents than us, I think. Because they never had much, but they made sure that we never was out. You know what I mean? But parenting, you're still learning when you're a parent as well, don't you? You never know how to be a parent. Everyone's different, isn't it? All your kids are different.
Do you feel better for sharing that? Is that something that's been on your mind for a while?
A lot of my friends know about it anyway.
Yeah.
A lot of people know about that. Like, listen, it is what it is, isn't it? Like, they was good parents. I classed him as a dad anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't matter because he was your dad
anyway. Yeah, he's still a dad anyway.
Mm. You retired at 35.
Yeah.
Were you worried about being pulled back into the streets at all?
Yeah, big time. And I nearly did get involved back in the streets until one of my good friends, who's a character, sat me down and said, listen, there's nothing else on the streets for you. You've come too far to get sucked back into it. But a lot of people don't realise that when you play football and when you end, and I've not earned that big money, and people have not told you where to invest money or whatever, that money goes quickly. And then you're wondering, where's your next pound note coming from? And that's how it was. It was stressful times.
It's great advice from your pal, though, to sit you down in it and
yeah,
give
big
you that.
Time. Big time. And that's what I said. I've always had people around me who genuinely care about you.
But by the time you've gone through non-league and retired, so how much, you don't have to give me a figure here, but have you spent a lot of your money?
Yeah, you spent near enough all your money, and even all your savings are going to dwindle away very quickly. Even these pensions are no good. You know what I mean? There's nothing in them pensions. And you've got to start all over again.
You still got outgoings the day you retire, and you don't realise how big they are.
They're massive. When you're in it, you don't see it. You're just living that football life. Then come out of it, then I had to reinvent myself. You know, where I had to go and take a personal training certificate, level 3. And even that was daunting. You know, like going back in the classroom. I mean, I hadn't been in a classroom for like 15 years, something like that. And then you've got all these young pups on there who are going like, and I'm like, and I said to the guy at the examiner, I said to him, listen, I don't know if this is for me, for after 2 days. And he's gone, Jay, like, I've seen you in the gym. We'll get you through the theory, right? I said, that other stuff is easy to you. And then I pissed it in the end. And I was off and running. And then one, it's all about being positive. Like, after I've done that, I got my book come out after that. Then I went on GMTV again. Then a school reached out to me. Will you come and work in our school, which was in South London, where I come from? It's meant to be for naughty kids, disadvantaged kids. And I went and worked there for 5 years, which gave me purpose. And then I set up my own academy as well. And them boys who they said were meant to be naughty, they was not naughty. They just needed a little bit of guidance and to be challenged daily and a message to be the same daily. You cannot change your message daily with these kids. A lot of these kids now, they're about 30-something now. They come and see me. A lot of them have got their own business, they've got families and whatever. They come and see me, sit down and have a drink and have a chat.
What's usually missing in their lives?
Maybe a father. You know what I mean? Some of them have got fathers who are absent, some are in prison. And they don't know no better. So I've had boys where I've come and they've done work experience in my academy with me, and they see how I teach the older boys and the way I teach them, because I use football as a vehicle with these young boys. One of them's late, they all get punished. To the point where they start policing themselves. They start setting their own standards. And then you just see them growing as young men, even the way they're carrying. I used to walk around the school and they'd be misbehaving. And now come round, they stop instantly. Because that's the respect they had for me.
You don't have to say anything.
I don't have to say nothing. And they knew by the look as well sometimes. Even my older boys I coach, if I give them a look, they'd be like to each other, we need to fix up because we're going to run in a minute.
Did you see a lot of yourself in some of the boys at all?
Yeah.
Is that why you knew exactly what to say to them?
Yeah.
And what they needed?
Yeah, and most of them know that I've been there. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So they know I identify with them.
What, do people still reach out to you now just for some help and guidance?
Loads of people reach out to me. Even on social media, people I don't know will reach out to me.
Can you, without naming names, can you give us an example of what they might be asking you?
Some people, they're talking about going back on the road, doing shit on the road. And is it worth it? I said, no. And they're like, but I can't, it's like they can't seem to get ahead in life. I said, listen, you've got to take each day as it comes. I said, listen, I prefer to be out here free than being in there with no freedom. I mean, I'd rather be broke out here than in there.
You've got your Jamie Lawrence Academy. You've worked with multiple national teams and strength and conditioning work with the likes of Reece James, Ruben Loftus-Cheek. What does it mean to you that these types of players put their trust in you?
You know what? With Reece, Chelsea actually put their trust in me.
Great.
Jody was there at the time. And he's saying that Reece at the time never knew how far he could go mentally. And mentally is the most important thing in sport in general. So he said, Jay, can I send him to you for a month? I want you to give him your treatment.
Who is this, sorry?
Jody Morris.
Right, okay.
Yeah, he used to play at Chelsea. He was assistant manager at Chelsea as well. So he sent him to me. I had him for a month. And then, I'm not saying this because of me, but he's gone back and he's gone from strength to strength. And what a player he is, by the way. With Ruben now, I love Ruben. Ruben's one of my favourite ones.
Pre-season or one-on-one extra sessions?
Ruben done one-on-one. Reece was pre-season. Ruben, when he went to the World Cup, Gareth had rung him and said to him, listen, if you're fit, you go to the World Cup. So he rung me straight away and said, Jay, can we do some sessions? I've done some sessions with him and he went to the World Cup. But I was speaking to him last week and all that. He always keeps in contact with me. Very respectful young man. A good kid.
I think with Jamie, what I've seen of what he puts on Instagram and the way he deals with these youngsters, he'll tell you how it is. Like, he's not going to sugarcoat anything. No. He's not going to wrap you in cotton wool. He's going to tell you, listen, if you don't want to get to that line, then you're not going to, you know, have what it takes to be a player. If you don't run that extra yard, if you're going to come and put in less than 100% effort, then don't bother turning up. He's very firm with them, aren't you?
Yeah, you have to be. Because, like, there's a lot of coaches out here just lie to players. I've always said that I'm going to be honest with them. If they don't like it, they don't like it. But at least I've told them the truth. You know what I mean? And everyone can learn.
For someone like Reece James, who you could say is a future England captain, right? Yeah. What did he need mentally from you to go to that next level?
He just never knew where he could go, like how far you could be pushed. Listen, it sounds like I'm battering sports science all the time, yeah? But when people are telling you that you're in the red zone, that you can come in and all that, football's not like that. That's when you're just getting going. Because football's about wearing the opposition down. Like, me as a winger, I want to run at you every single time because the law of averages for me, like, in my favour, I need to get past you once. And the more tired you are, the more liable you are to make a mistake. And this is why you have to train at this level. Like, no one can't make my ceiling for me. I make my own ceiling.
Who else have you worked with?
Ghana national team. We went to the final of the African Nations and went to the semi-final. I've worked with Zambia as well. Gone to African Nations with them as well. But even when I went to Ghana the first time and all that, they never liked me at the beginning. They hated me because they had never done nothing like it before. But because we went to the tournament, we was the fittest in the tournament by far. We was winning games late on as well. And we was steamrolling teams. And then they all bought into it. I enjoyed working in Africa, but the corruption, especially in Zambia, was too much.
Yeah, what do you have to deal with?
What didn't we have to deal with? Like, we've got players coming from all over and they're getting them the worst flights available. They should all be going on business class, right? But they will get them a flight, they'll have a 10-hour layover in the airport, then having another connecting flight. And you want them to perform to the best. It was a joke. Then they want to interfere with who you pick. And I know the last AFCON, that's why the gaffer got the sack in the first place. Because they can now influence who they're picking. Ghana or Zambia have not got their own training ground. They're scratching around to go and train different places. Especially Ghana. How have Ghana been to so many World Cups and you have not got your own training pitch, not even got a gym, not got nothing because of the corruption? They're so stupid. Like, the better you do, the more money there is. They're all short-term goals.
So where's it going, basically?
That's what I'm saying.
Could you work with Jamaica? Would you want to?
I would love to work with my country, but I know that they're probably even worse than Africa. So, nah, I would help my country all day long, and people have reached out to me, would you help them and all that? I would, but everything has to be right. You know, like, getting people like Steve McLaren to manage Jamaica, not the right way to go. And he knows, he never liked that. I said it, I know he never liked that.
You said it quite early, didn't you?
Said it early, didn't I? I said it. It was a retirement fund for him. Mm. You know, it's like he's embracing Jamaica. Who don't want to go to Jamaica? But he was doing it for the wrong reasons. And he was inept. He weren't good enough.
Has this film been made yet about
no,
you?
No, the film will be made very soon. We started writing the script yesterday. The boys I'm involved in, they're looking about the money. They're going to have a phone call next week. And hopefully they'll just secure the money to make the film. But it will be out within 18 months to 2 years.
You're going to get Luke a role?
What are we going to have? To be fair, you could act my best mate Spiller. Just skinhead.
It will seem like another ridiculously far-fetched football movie, though, wouldn't it? Yeah. Rags to riches story. It doesn't actually seem like it was a real story, but yeah, it certainly was.
Yeah, it definitely was. Still living it. Still many chapters to go.
Who's playing you?
I don't know, you know. Because you have to have two, three different actors. You've got to have a young one. Then when you get to about 20 and that, and then a little bit older.
Can't you do it yourself, mate?
Nah, I'm not good at acting. forget my lines.
I'm assuming then that there's stuff that's been kept back. I know you've got a book. You've told your story so many times. But is there anything you could share here about that film that potentially would be a new insight for everybody?
Nah, it's just... just really a story of resilience, isn't it? Like, you could be down on your luck, but you can always come back from it. And you've got to be very, very careful, I say to everyone, in how you treat people, right? Because that can come back around. Like, if I went in there and went into prison as a prick, then prison officers would never have helped me, and there would have been no coming back. So, like, manners, respect goes a long, long way. It could save your life, which it did me.
Is that what you tell the kids when you work with them?
Yeah, 100%. That's the first thing you should have, is manners and respect. Right. We can all get it wrong, but you also got to be honest as well. When you've got it wrong, just put your hands up and just say, and I've done that with numerous managers, right, and that's why they forgave me in the end as well, with Paul Jewell and Martin O'Neill. And in life, sometimes you've got to be honest, like, there's certain things I'm not proud of, like being a shit boyfriend and whatever. I'm sorry about all that, but like, I've done it, but I put my hands up and I know that I was a shit boyfriend.
Do you find it hard to be in relationships nowadays, or?
Yeah, I do. Like, I don't really trust many people out here no more. Like, women are not the same as well. All this social media bullshit as well. It's like competing with the Joneses and that. And yeah, I find it hard to be in relationships. I've got my kids and that. That's the only relationships I really need. I've got my friends. So if I see someone for a little bit, it's all good. As long as you're honest about why you're seeing them and that, it's all good.
What if there are kids out there that genuinely don't have a hope? They're in an environment where they don't feel safe. They don't feel like they've got a prospect. What do they do there?
Listen, there's a lot of things what I've done which made me better. You've got to change the environment. You cannot stay in the same environment and grow. That's what I said to you very early, like, the best thing what happened to me when I came out of prison, I had them trials in London, is that I went up north. I'm away from all the noise. So if you're in a situation here, try and change your environment and it can get better. When you're stuck somewhere, you can't see anything. You're just surviving.
My final question, when I say the name Jamie Lawrence, what do you think?
Proud. I'm glad I made my mum and dad proud. That's the biggest thing for me. And my kids look up to me and they're proud as well. And that means everything, like my friends as well, all of them are proud. And that's the biggest thing as well.
Thank you for your time. I know you've shared a lot today.
You're welcome, my friend.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it, mate. Brilliant.
Thank you, Jamie. And don't forget to check out some of our previous episodes as well. We've had some fascinating guests, including James Haskell, Stylian Petrov, and Becky Adlington as well. You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at More Than A Name Pod. You can email us morethananamepod@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. Jamie Lawrence, you're a legend. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.